I wonder if you ever feel that sometimes life can be totally and bitterly unfair. Maybe it's something personal, maybe it's something on a national level. I think one of the thing that epitomises this maybe more than any others in recent years at a national level is that of Jimmy Savile. Jimmy Savile, when he died in 1914, he died as a national icon, a hero, a true sort of British treasure. Even with his quirky tracksuits and his voice and that kind of sort of thing. But he was that famed radio and DJ and TV presenter. He was known for all of his charity work, particularly that with hospitals. He was given an OBE, he was knighted. And when he died, 4,000 people came to show their respect to his passing. Leeds Cathedral was full of mourners before he was then buried. But then that seems totally unfair. He died this national hero when it was after his death the truth came out about what Jimmy Savile was really like and what he really got up to. How unfair. How wrong that is. We can feel that, can't we? He got away with it, scot-free. It seems so wrong. And it is. Without God. Without God. And that sense of, it's so unfair, it just doesn't seem right, like how on earth? That is the question that Habakkuk has got in his mind as he made his first question to God and got the response that we looked at last week and how that then plays out. Judah, God's people, the southern kingdom under King Josiah, went through the best of times. Josiah restored order and worship to the Lord, rebuilt the temple and started teaching the Bible again, the ancient scrolls of the Old Testament, and it was good times for God's people. But then he died, and the next king, and it was Jehoiakim, and he sent the country to ruin, no longer worshipping the true God, but worshipping false gods. Instead of righteousness, it was unrighteousness. Instead of justice, it was injustice. Instead of honesty, it was dishonesty. It was a godless place. And the prophet Habakkuk calls out to God. We saw it last week. Why? Why, God, don't you do something? Look how far we have fallen. Look how bad it is. And God said, in response, verse 6, I'm raising up the Babylonians. The Babylonians are going to be my act of justice for you to deal with all this wrong. The Babylonians. And now Habakkuk is going, what? The Babylonians? Are you serious? This horrible, terrible people. I mean, look how God described them in verse 6. I'm raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling on their own. Now, as Habakkuk is playing on this and plays out, but how is this okay? Look how he describes them in verse 15. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net, describing how the Babylonians with King Nebuchadnezzar are like the fishermen grabbing all of the Israelites and taking them captive, like, and how wicked and wrong they are. I mean, and you can feel Habakkuk's question, can't you? That he asks him why in verse 13, why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Yeah, sure, the people of Judah, God's people, haven't got everything right, he's saying. But look, the Babylonians are way worse. But you're using them to bring about justice? Why? That seems so unfair. That seems so wrong. As he asks that, he states who God is. Verse 12, Lord, are you not from everlasting, my God, my Holy One? Will you never die? You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, have ordained them to punish. He's affirming who God is. Then he asks those two why questions in verse 13. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous, those Babylonians? Why do you tolerate them and letting them do this? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? It seems so unfair. It seems so wrong. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy, verse 17? I wonder if I ever feel like that. Maybe it's the Jimmy Savile thing, maybe it's something else, maybe it's something in our own lives. We just go, that's just so unfair. If God is really God, why doesn't he just do something? And why does he use that and not do this in order to bring it about? I wonder if we ever find ourselves asking those questions. And as we do so, we doubt God's goodness. We doubt who God is. Because that is Habakkuk's second question. And the answer to it, as God gives him in chapter 2, is that judgment is to come. The Babylonians, they will be judged. Chapter 2, verse 3. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. This judgment on the Babylonians, it will come. They won't, quotation marks, get away with it. And as Habakkuk gives his second question, his thinking is disjoint. He hasn't got it right in his mind. It's the thing we're thinking about earlier on before the children left. Look, he's not doubting, he's not questioning God. He affirms who God is as he comes to ask his question. Chapter 1, verse 12, he's everlasting. God, you're holy. God, you're my rock. You're the Lord. You will punish evil. I know it. But like how, he's believing it, but he doesn't get how that's going to play through. How it's going to work in what seems so unfair and so wrong, using the Babylonians, this incredibly evil people, as his rod of justice on his people. There's some disjoint in his thinking. He's not quite sort of getting it, how it works through. He believes who God is, but he doesn't get who God is. And it's becoming a stumbling block. And as he plays this through in his life, as he sees this coming through this chapter, we see the dots starting to join up for Habakkuk. As he sees God's judgment, as sees God's character as spoken about and played out. So the first thing we see is God's patience held. God's patience held in chapter 2, verses 1 to 5. So chapter 2, verse 1, Habakkuk says, I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to his complaint. I will stand watch and station myself on the ramparts, as though Habakkuk is saying, I'm waiting, God, here's my question, give me the answer. It's like a teacher or a parent when a child's been naughty and they say, well, why did you do that? I'm waiting, give me the answer, come on, I'm waiting for it. It's almost impetuous of Habakkuk as he's waiting for the answer. And the reply comes. Chapter 2, verse 2. Then the Lord replied, write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. The enemy, they are not the righteous ones, verse 4. They are not the righteous ones. They are faithless. They are puffed up. They are arrogant. Pride and power. Those are the two things that basically sum up Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians, and the Babylonian nation. That is what they are all about. Pride and power. Status and success. We see that through the woes of judgment later on in chapter 2. And see what God says about this judgment. Verse 3, for the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end. The judgment is coming. The judgment is coming. Just like, you know, you watch the news and the weather reporter says, watch out, there's a big storm coming. Look, here are the clouds. Here's all the formations. The lines are really close together. You need to get yourself ready. It's going to be a big storm. Judgment is coming. Everyone needs to get ready. It speaks of the end. And it will not prove false. It's true. God's not lying. God's not making it up. God's not speaking a half-truth or a wrong truth or no truth. No, he is saying this will happen. It will not prove false. It won't be sort of not quite so bad for the Babylonians. No, it will be the full rod of God's judgment on the Babylonians. It is true. But it may be delayed. It may be delayed in coming. Though it linger, wait for it. it will not prove false. Just like, you know, when you go to the airport for your holiday, you see the you go up on the board, you see the boards and say plane delayed. It doesn't mean the plane's not going to come. It just means it's not here yet. It's coming. Hopefully it's coming, but it's not here yet. And so with God's judgment. It's delayed. It's God being patient. But it will come. It will come. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come. And when it does, it will not delay. It will certainly come. The Enron scandal took up lots of the news in the early 2000s in America. And there's a whole sort of a bunch of people were sent to prison for the ways they were caught up in the scandal and misusing funds and the like. And one couple, Andrew and Leah Fausto, were caught up in it. They were two of the financial executives caught up in a scandal. They were both found guilty and were due to be sent to prison. But they had a young child. So Andrew Fausto's sentence was delayed by a year while his wife, Leah, took her sentence so that he could be at home looking after his child before then he too was then sent to prison and she'd been released. Every day of that year, Andrew Fausto would have known judgment was coming. His time was coming, was going to be in prison for his crimes. The judgment was coming for him. And God says to Habakkuk, the judgment on the Babylonians, it's coming. But yet God's patience is held. And you know, when we reflect on that, when we think of that, that can be assuring, but yet it can also be alarming. It can be assuring in that when we see the injustices of the world around us, we know actually there will one day be justice. And not just in sort of our court of law, but on the ultimate stage of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who will be the ultimate judge for eternity of life in the new heavens and the new earth, or eternity of judgment and condemnation and being cut off from God. The ultimate judgment. That's the assurance when we see injustice around us going seemingly undealt with. But it also can be alarming. Because how do we stand before that judgment? How do I stand before that judgment? But the righteous person will live by his faithfulness. And as we ponder on that, and as we look onto that through the rest of chapter 2, I'm going to invite the Emmanuel Juniors to go next door for their own teaching and thinking on that. Wonderful. So we've got there, so we've got God's patience held, and then we move on to the woes, the judgment that God is going to give, and it's God's judgment given. God's patience held, God's judgment given. And God speaks of five woes, and the woes are woes of judgment, woes of sorrow, of distress, of what is going to happen to the Babylonians for their rejection of God. And in each of the five woes that we're just going to quickly scan over and see, we'll see their sin, how they've rejected God being pinpointed, but also the judgment that they will receive. So we see there the first woe in verse 6. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their prey, because you have plundered many nations. The peoples who are left will plunder you, for you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. The first woe, it's greed. It's greed. Wanting things for themselves. Woe to him who piles up, literally piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by exaltation. It's greed of money, of wealth, of power. That's the desire of the Babylonians and King Nebuchadnezzar. That's what drives them. That's what motivates them. And even leads them to plunder and to kill for it. Greed. That's their motive. Drives and pushes them. Their love for money instead of God. I wonder what drives us, what our motives, what makes us tick. If we ever find ourselves wondering that and sort of just think about what do we think about in our default? When we can't get to sleep at night, what's the thing that comes to mind? What do we think about? Often that can be the thing actually that is our motive. That is what can be the idol of our heart, the thing that shapes us. Yet see, though, verse 7, will not your creditors suddenly arise? That's the judgment. Will they not wake up and make you tremble? The judgment to come for the Babylonians' greed. That's the first woe. And the second one is this. It's for relying on the wrong thing. Verse 9, woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain, setting his nest on high to escape the clutches of the ruin. The Babylonians think that money is their protection. They've got enough money, they can build themselves a big enough house, a big enough castle, a big enough nest, and that is the thing that will protect them. Like a bird will set their nest up on high to protect themselves from any other predators. So that is what the Babylonians are doing. I mean, not literally a nest, but that kind of picture of language. High, lofty place, big fortress to protect themselves. Their security is in their status. It's in their success. Their security is in their money, in their power, in their pride and in their arrogance, thinking that they can buy themselves security. Yet Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, do not store up yourselves treasures on earth where moth or vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasure in heaven where moth and vermin do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Treasure in heaven, not treasure on earth. They're relying on the wrong thing for their protection. Thinking that if I have this, then I'll have my security, then I'll be big enough and powerful enough and great enough. Verse 11, the stones of the wall will cry out and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. It will reflect in how they live and what shapes them. And that is true, isn't it? If we're about fast cars and wanting, that's our thing, then that will reflect in what car we have and how we use our money and how we use our time. That's the second woe. And the third and fourth woe, they're quite similar. They're all about using violence in order to bring about gain. Verse 12, it's the bloodshed. They build their city using bloodshed to establish a town by injustice. And then verse 15, woe to him who gives drink to his neighbours, pouring it from wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. You'll be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and let your nakedness be exposed. Their violence, verse 17, will overwhelm you. The destruction of your animals will terrify you. You have shed human blood. It's debauchery. It's violence. It's drunkenness. Using violence in order for their gain. Shedding blood. Destroying land. It's the greed that plays out from that heart wanting status and success, pride and power, that plays through in how they behave, in how they treat those around them. And verse 13, they will be under God's judgment for this. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire and the nation exhausts themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. God's knowledge, God's glory, God's power will be over it all. He will act in judgment. The Lord God, who's head of the heavenly army, he will punish injustice and he will destroy. He will destroy them for all of their wrongs. The fake idols, the wooden objects, verse 18, that make will lead to nothing. And that is the final woe there in verse 19. Woe to him who says to wood, come to life. Or to the lifeless stone, wake up. Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. It looks brilliant. There is no breath in it. And that's the final woe. It's that they're worshipping idols, false gods, instead of the true God. The God who will be known across all seas, over all lands, across the whole earth. The Lord in his holy temple. They're not worshipping him, they're worshipping these false things instead. And woe for their idol worship. Woe to him, verse 19, it says to wood, come to life. Or to the lifeless stone, wake up. I mean, can you imagine it? Imagine sort of, you know, the car is your thing, a sort of Maserati. You spent all your money, saved, and now you bought your new car and it's outside and you spend the whole time just wanting to shine it and gleam it and to show it off to people. The car's not going to talk to you. It might make a nice, pleasing brrrr, but it's not going to sort of talk to you and like sort of, oh, brilliant. Now, tell me, car, how to live. Like, the car will just sit there, won't it? It won't do anything. It's an inanimate object. Why worship that when we can worship the true God? The true God, who will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The true God, the Lord, who is in his holy temple. God's judgment is given. And in the year 539 BC, that's exactly what happened with the fall of the Babylonian nation. God's patience kept. God's judgment given. And it doesn't just end there, because all of those two things has points to something even more. It points to God's glory about who he is. What Habakkuk has affirmed about God way back at the beginning of our reading this morning, as he comes to ask his second question to God, he affirms who God is. So through the whole of this answer that God gives, he is reminding Habakkuk of who he is and demonstrating and reaffirming through his promised patient judgment. Look at verse 14 again. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Look, this is the working out of God's judgment, and it points to God's glory. A judgment is one of those taboo words, isn't it? You know, we talk about God's judging, we feel slightly awkward, and like, you know, it's not very sort of British, not sort of thing we talk about, and sort of feel slightly awkward about it. You know, we don't like to think about God judging. But just because we don't like something, doesn't therefore mean it's not true. And actually, if God is God, who he claims to be, and to be the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God, then actually he does need to judge. Because otherwise the world would be totally unfair and totally unjust. He needs to judge, and it points to him. It points to his glory, for the earth to be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. And again in verse 20, the Lord is in his holy temple, let the earth be silent before him. Silent not meaning in fear or in shock, but in awe. You know, when you see something amazing and you just like, your jaw just drops, you go, oh, that's amazing. It's that sort of silence of awe and wonder above who God is, of how great God is, his glory displayed. And you know, it's even more amazing for us, isn't it? As we live in the light of the cross and the resurrection, we see that actually we deserve judgment for us in our rejection of God, but yet we don't need to receive it. Because of God's great goodness and God's faithfulness and love played out in the death of his son Jesus Christ and in the resurrection. We have the far greater vantage point now from Habakkuk. Being able to see the prophecy of Habakkuk, but through the lens of the cross and resurrection. And seeing how God deals with his judgments. Seeing even more of God's glory. Doesn't that silence us in awe and wonder of who God is? And of how great God is? You know, sometimes we have that disjoint, don't we? Like Habakkuk had, like we believe who God is, but we just don't get how that plays through in life. And when we find ourselves at those points, see again and again who God is, his glory on show, in God's patience displayed, in God's glory shown, in God's judgment given, in showing his glory. And when we find ourselves in that situation, we hold to what we know. We hold to what we know. The goodness, the glory of the Lord God. C.S. Lewis once says this, faith is the act of holding on to things your reason has once accepted, in spite of a change of mood. Faith is the act of holding on to things your reason has once accepted, in spite of a changing change of mood. That means that despite that something might happen we don't get or seems wrong or seems unfair, that doesn't deny what we know to be true and what we see to be true of God here. That God is patient, that God judges, and his glory on show. So we keep looking, we keep trusting. We can be like those in chapter 2, verse 4. Righteous, right with God by trusting in him and relying in faithfulness on him, looking to him. And like Habakkuk, moving our questions from why to that of worship, of who God is and his great goodness on us.